You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the COVID-19 outbreak is really hurting the national economy, but rural areas could ultimately be hit the hardest. We'll talk to a Wisconsin economist about how these communities could fare in the coming months and years. Right now, getting through a national crisis, especially one like the COVID-19 pandemic, calls for public unity working toward a common purpose. But with politics and public discourse in the United States as polarized as they are, that's easier said than done. In some places, adherence to public health measures are being looked at through a political lens. To understand why and how to create more unity, it helps to think about how our brains operate, both during times of crisis and deep conflict. Amanda Ripley is a contributing writer at The Atlantic and a senior fellow at the Emerson Collective. Her books include The Unthinkable, Who Survives When Disaster Strikes, and Why. Amanda, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, before we get into what's going on right now, I want to go back to something we've talked about in the past, Amanda, the idea of high conflict, times when people really disagree and traditional roads to bridging gaps start to make things worse. Remind us what that is, that idea of high conflict.
Yeah, so most of the time, conflict is actually a really good and healthy thing. It's something we need in order to, you know, get better and protect ourselves and just communicate and coordinate. But at a certain level of sort of us versus them intensity, particularly group conflict, can become something that researchers call high conflict, which means it operates very differently from normal everyday conflict, and it becomes kind of like a perpetual motion machine, you know? It takes on a life of its own, and the more you do to kind of get out of it, the worse it often gets. And so it is a special kind of level of conflict that normal rules don't really work on.
You've been watching high conflict in the United States for a while. As the coronavirus pandemic emerged, how did that play out? Did we see it reduced? Did we reach out to across those lines, or did we just play out along those lines of conflict?
I think you're seeing it in both ways in different places. So as an example, there is certainly a spike in unity and solidarity, which is great. And you see that during every major disaster ever, that people come together. They don't want to focus on differences. They can see that we have a shared and common enemy and that we need to help each other. There was a new poll that just came out from More in Common and YouGov that found that 90% of Americans believe that we're all in it together. And that compares to just 63% in the fall of 2018. So the percentage of Americans who say we're very divided as a country has dropped from 62% to just 22%. So that is a sign that this is functioning like other disasters in the past, that this kind of thing really brings people together, brings out the best in people more often than not. So that's encouraging. At the same time, we are seeing that people who are strong partisans, so this is not your average American, but people who are very much very partisan, left or right, so about a third of the country, those people are experiencing a total different reality. And that was true before this pandemic and continues to be true now. You can see it in that same More in Common poll where liberal activists are three times as likely as devoted conservatives to think it's likely they will become ill with the coronavirus, and twice as likely as conservatives to say that someone they know will become ill. So there's a lot of anxiety about their health on the left, and also about the role of the media, whereas liberal activists are very supportive of what the media is doing, the news media. People on the right are very distrustful of the news media. So you have the exhausted majority in the middle, which is about two-thirds of the country, who are not seeing this necessarily through a very partisan lens, but you have people on the ends who are, and many of those people are people in elected office, right? So as well as sort of pundits and other people who are high profile. So that kind of distorts the way that we're seeing this and the way that others are seeing it.
It distorts it. Does it, in a way, poison the well for everybody? If you have this maybe small but very vocal and in some cases prominent minority taking the high conflict approach to a crisis like this?
What it does is it makes everyone suffer. And this is true in every high conflict all over the world, that you get so threatened by the other side. This is just a very human psychological response to very intense conflict. You get so threatened by the other side and so focused on winning and not letting your guard down that you feel like you can't trust anything the other side does and that you have to win at all costs. So when you're dealing with a pandemic, which requires really extraordinary public cooperation and trust and unity and coordination, that's very dangerous. So going into this, I mean, one thing I know, I've covered a lot of disasters over the years. That used to be like my beat, actually. And one thing I learned was that the resilience of a community after a disaster is directly predicted by its health before the incident, right? So that sometimes is more important than the actual incident itself. And what we had here in the United States was a pre-existing condition of high conflict, particularly in politics. Again, not everyone was bought into it, but the people with the biggest microphones were bought into it.
Amanda Ripley is with us. She's the author of books, including The Unthinkable, Who Survives When Disaster Strikes and Why. We've talked to her many times on Central Time about divisions in American society and ways to reach out across them. Amanda, talking about that idea of trust and the way authority figures can earn that trust, I want to take a detour through Milwaukee history. You wrote about this, a smallpox outbreak from, 120, 130 years ago. Can you share that story and what we can learn from it?
Right. So the story starts out bad and gets better. So bear with me. But in the summer of 1894, there was a smallpox outbreak in Milwaukee, as you said. This happened all the time back then. This was not a new problem in the United States, but it was always very frightening. And one night, health officials headed to a Milwaukee home to take a sick two-year-old to the hospital, and they were met by several thousand locals who surged into the streets, and they had knives and bricks and bats, and the mother would not allow her child to be taken. Police drew their guns so they didn't fire, and the ambulance ended up leaving empty. All that month, riots happened through, particularly in the poorest parts of Milwaukee, which meant that smallpox was spread upon the most vulnerable in the city. 1,079 people got sick, 244 died. And this happened after a smallpox vaccine had become available. So the mystery for people who study human behavior in disasters was, you know, what happened here? Because that's not the way this went every time or in every place. And what we've learned is that the public will cooperate with public directives and make big sacrifices, but there's some conditions that have to be met. And probably the most important one is basic fairness. The public has to feel like whatever's happening is being done fairly. And in Milwaukee, back then, that did not happen. So what happened was the health commissioner had allowed families in middle and upper class areas of the city to self-quarantine in their own homes when they got sick. But in the more crowded, dense German and Polish immigrant neighborhoods, the city had forcibly removed and hospitalized the ill because of what they said were unsanitary conditions. So on the one hand, you can see why they might have made this argument. On the other hand, this felt incredibly unfair to people whose children were being taken from them. And they did not trust the hospital, and they had good reasons not to trust the hospital. So that really poisoned the entire public health response. People would not get vaccinated. They wouldn't allow their kids to be taken. So that's an example of why it's super important for public health authorities and politicians to make sure that whatever they're doing, whatever they're asking of people, it be applied fairly.
Have we
learned
from
that? Oh, and I promised it would...
Yeah,
sorry,
you promised it was going to get better, Amanda, yeah.
And then I just left either. I apologize. So the good news, such as it is, was that, you know, if you compare that, as researchers have done, to another outbreak that happened in New York City about 50 years later. New York City had had terrible experiences with outbreaks too, by the way. But this one in particular started out looking a lot like what happened in Milwaukee. The vast majority of New Yorkers were not vaccinated. They had no immunity to smallpox, which was introduced by a visitor from out of state. But in this case, the health commissioner decided not to forcibly hospitalize sick people, although he could have under the law. Instead, he really enlisted the public. Like, he seemed to have this kind of deep faith in the public, and that came across. So he held daily news conferences. He delivered clear, consistent, transparent messages about what needed to be done. There was a big kind of messaging campaign. They offered free vaccinations in every public and parochial school in the city. The mayor got vaccinated himself. So there was this real push that, you know, we're all in this together and we trust you and we know you can do this and we're going to help you and we're going to make it fair and accessible. And in 1 month, more than 6 million New Yorkers got vaccinated voluntarily. So people waited online hours for their turn, sometimes coming back the next day. And the projections for the fatalities in advance, they were fearing that about 5,000 people would die based on previous smallpox outbreaks in New York City. In the end, there were just 12 cases and 2 deaths. So that was a real lesson about how if you enlist the public and inform them and tell them the truth about what's happening, you really show that you respect their autonomy, they will respect you back.
We're talking with journalist Amanda Ripley right now about different responses people are having to the public health measures being taken during the COVID-19 pandemic, how a partisan divide may be influencing some people's reactions, and what to look for in leadership and public messaging when it comes to an outbreak like this. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you worry that people are looking at the novel coronavirus through a political lens, an overly political lens? Do you see this maybe on your social media feed, since you can't really talk to people in person quite as much? What would you like to see from leadership at the local, state, national level, in the media for that matter? Do you think the U.S. can rally around a common purpose in a time of crisis? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And if you see encouraging signs along these lines, I'd love to hear that too. 800-642-1234 is the number. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Amanda Ripley, contributor for The Atlantic and senior fellow at the Emerson Collective, looking at how the COVID-19 pandemic is becoming a divisive issue, at least for some Americans, and how to move past it and maybe have a sense of unity. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen people looking at public health measures through a political lens, deciding to follow or not follow them based on where they are in the partisan divide? What do you think leaders in the media can do to bring about unity during the crisis? Do you see positive signs out there and how it with people coming together in your own community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Amanda, I wanted to get your thoughts on how we talk about these kind of things in the media. We've talked about this with you before on issues like guns, for example, and a lot of other things. What are good ways to frame things without, you know, heightening the extreme divides?
Yeah, I cringe a little when I see people, reporters, really fixate on the division between, say, Dr. Fauci and President Trump, or you know, really like all if your entire focus is on whether these guys get along or not. I fear that you're kind of missing the big picture. Like, that is, yes, that is an interesting and important question. It is not the only interesting and important question, right? That is basically taking the old school approach to journalism, where we just, you know, look for a boxing match and just, you know, say what happened, and applying it to a very urgent and different kind of crisis, right? So it's not particularly helpful to people. And people really do need information right now. They want information. They want to be told the truth. So I think it's understandable that reporters will do that, but I don't think it's particularly helpful past a certain point. I mean, I think, you know, the reality is complicated. Like, I hate to say it, but it really is. I mean, we know from every study of every disaster ever that humans always start with a period of denial and disbelief that it's happening. That is a very normal and natural response to something that has never happened before to you personally and seems unlikely, right? So we all do this. Every firefighter has a story about this, about walking into a bar, say it's full of people sipping their drinks and there's smoke, you know, moving across the ceiling and nobody's moving, right? Cancer patients, when they get diagnosed, some of them will just, you know, act as if it's not happening for weeks sometimes. There have been, you know, studies on this. It happens in all kinds of situations, even like really life or death situations, and also slow motion disasters like a pandemic. So it may look to some people like this is, oh, you know, it's a political, people are politicizing this and they're not reacting, or they're going to the beach, or, you know, they're refusing to take it seriously. And that may be true in some cases. And it's also true that psychologically, we are hardwired to assess risk using emotional shortcuts, right? And the higher the level of uncertainty, the more emotional shortcuts we will use. So that means it's basically impossible to get this just right as a human. Like, you're gonna on some days overreact and then some days underreact. I notice that even in myself, right? Like, some days I'm much more attuned to it and, you know, going crazy with the disinfectant wipes, and other days I'm much more chill, and, you know, and it's hard to get it right because it's very unpredictable. So it's really difficult to disentangle the political and the psychological, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And, you know, there's this huge genre in pop culture. There's books, TV shows, movies where, you know, the apocalypse, whatever it is, comes, and all of a sudden it's Mad Max, and, you know, we're, you know, shooting at each other on the streets and remote outposts and Walking Dead and all these things. Having seen how people react in disasters, it sounds like there's a lot more positive response than we might get from the stuff we read and watch.
Yeah, there's a really human instinct that kicks in where people become social. So after that initial denial phase, which could last, depending on the situation, it could last 5 seconds or 5 months, right? After that denial phase, there's a deliberation phase where people get really social. So they check in with each other. What are you doing? What are you doing? People won't evacuate for a hurricane, for example, until they've checked with like at least 5 other sources they trust. So that could be the weatherman, it could be their neighbor, their aunt, whatever. And so it becomes a really social endeavor. And that's simply because it's in our survival interests to operate as a group and learn from each other. Most of the time, people actually behave better than they do normally, if that makes sense. Like, it's not like rush hour on the freeway. It's a very different set of norms and emotions are at play. The single biggest question people get who evacuated from the World Trade Center on 9/11, the most common question they get asked is, what was it like in the stairwell as you were evacuating, you know, which took hours? And what they say is, it was really quiet and calm, and people were helping each other and passing up water bottles and moving to the side for the firefighters. And that is very, very typical, even in slower motion disasters like this.
Talk to Amanda Ripley about how we respond to a crisis amid the coronavirus epidemic, the things that divide us, the things that bring us together. Let's bring on a caller. Gwen is on the line in Madison. Gwen, hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to make an observation that we don't have a coherent national message at this time. The care is very fragmented. The message is very fragmented. And I think it would be of benefit if the president and Dr. Fauci would give factual updates on a regular basis, let Dr. Fauci handle the medicine, and President Trump could handle the logistics of how they're getting supplies to needed areas. People are looking for leadership in a time of crisis. And I mean, when they had the fireside chats with President Roosevelt, people were glued to their radios.
Gwen, thanks a lot for the call. I want to bring Amanda in on that. We have these daily or almost daily conferences with the president, often Dr. Fauci and others. Do you think we're getting the kind of national messaging we need from whoever it's delivered by, Amanda?
No, we're absolutely not. And I hate to say that, because I know that when Trump supporters hear that, some of them feel like immediately defensive because of this high conflict that we were in before this pandemic, right? And so I don't mean it as an attack. I don't mean it as a sort of reflexive, slight on the president. What I mean is, I've seen this before. I've seen it before. I've seen it from the mayor of New Orleans. I've seen it from police chiefs all over the country in other disasters. What often happens is that people who are not getting good guidance or are not well prepared for something like this They tend to give inconsistent messaging. They tend to prioritize things that maybe don't matter as much as other things. And that is a very common and tragic mistake. So Gwen is absolutely right. We need consistency, we need coherence, and we need people to tell us the truth. And we are not getting that at the national level on consistent enough of a basis, right? Sometimes we are, sometimes we aren't. We are getting better information in many places, not all, at the state or local level, which is good news because most Americans trust their state or local leaders more than they trust the feds anyway. And the information is more customized to each specific town or state. So it's kind of a mixed bag. The way that emergency planners deal with uncertain information, because the truth is we don't know, right? There's a lot we don't know, so it's hard to be consistent and clear. But that, again, is an old problem. And the way that you deal with that is well established in, like, you know, tomes and tomes of histories and research into human behavior. What you do is you give people a range. You say, here's what we don't know. Here's why we don't know it. Here's what might change. You give people more information and you really trust them with everything you've got. And when you change, which happens, you acknowledge that too, right? So you say, you know what? In the beginning, we thought this wasn't, COVID-19 was not affecting young people as much. It turns out, because of these three reasons, we were wrong. And now we realize that it does affect young people. And so you just explicitly acknowledge it. And you don't have to commit to a fatality rate. You say it's between here and here, right? So people can deal with a lot of complexity in a situation like this more than normal, right? You're not trying to sell them a soft drink. You're trying to keep them alive. And they get that.
Amanda, thanks so much for joining us again. I always always appreciate talking to you.
Thanks for having me, Rob. Good to talk to you. Take care.
You too. Amanda Ripley is a contributing writer at The Atlantic and a senior fellow at the Emerson Collective. Her books include The Unthinkable, Who Survives When Disaster Strikes, and Why. She talked with us about how public health measures during the pandemic are becoming a polarizing issue for some and how to move closer to a unified response. Coming up, we'll talk about how the ongoing COVID-19 outbreak could impact already hard-hit rural economies. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, join Kate Archer-Kent and WPR Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson for a look at today's elections and what we know so far. Probably no actual results, though. Ideas Network. Now, as the novel coronavirus outbreak continues throughout the U.S. and the world, concerns have been raised over the health of the overall economy and how it will recover once the outbreak ends. But while recovery across the board could be slow, rural communities could be especially hard hit. Over the last decade, many rural areas have been slower to recover from the Great Recession, and agricultural and manufacturing industries in these areas bore the brunt of a trade war between the U.S. and international trade partners. Our next guest joins us to talk about the kind of economic slowdown we've seen in rural communities and what steps could be taken to make sure they do recover. Steve Deller is a professor at UW-Madison's Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics. He's also a community development specialist in the Center for Community and Economic Development. Steve, good to have you back with us.
Good afternoon.
Well, give us a sense of the state of rural economies in Wisconsin before this coronavirus pandemic started. How were they doing?
It really varies across the state. I think in general, you could say that as you said in your introductory comments, the rural Wisconsin has been slow to recover from the Great Recession. It's only recently that it's been getting back to where it was before the Great Recession. And then the trade wars hit, and that put the brakes on the recovery. And now this, so you're seeing a lot of rural areas get hit pretty hard by this. The unemployment numbers, for example, for February There are some rural counties where the unemployment rate is up around 8%. Compares to places like, say, Dane County, where Madison is at, where it's 2.5%, or some of the suburban Milwaukee counties that are around less than 3%. You see some of these rural counties with fairly high unemployment rates. Part of that's the time of the year. It's kind of a seasonal. Some of these rural economies are a little seasonal because of tourism and recreation. So the 8% is a little reflective of the time of the year that it is, but that's before the shutdown. Those are the February numbers. When the March numbers come out, we're probably going to see those numbers go up by three times. It could be possible that we'll see one in four people declaring unemployment when the March numbers come out.
When we talk about rural economies, Steve, people might think rural equals farms, and that's obviously part of the story, but can you give us a sense of the range of economic activity we have in rural Wisconsin?
It really does. There are many parts of Wisconsin, that rural Wisconsin, that are heavily dependent upon farming. And it's not so much the farmers, it's the food processing. Mm-hmm. And in Wisconsin, that's cheese. And we're seeing reports now that some dairy farmers are really getting hit hard because the cheese plants are shut down. They're shut down because they're either practicing the social distance or their export markets have been shut down. The transportation network has been shut down for a lot of these. A lot of the dairy products go into restaurants and go into schools and things like that. And those are all shut down. So while the demand for dairy products through grocery stores is pretty strong, it's not enough to make up for the disruption in the other supply chains. So before the coronavirus hit, milk prices, and again, depending on what classification of milk you're talking about, was over $17 a gallon, which is, but it was moving in the right direction. Which is what there was kind of a light at the end of the tunnel for a lot of dairy farmers, a lot of other types of farmers as well. But now, the last I saw, the price of a gallon of milk is down around $2 a gallon, which is the farmers are hemorrhaging money at that level. When you have cheese plants that are shutting down, and remember that about 90% of Wisconsin dairy milk goes into cheese production. And those cheese plants are shutting down, there's no place for the milk to go. So they basically have to dispose of it. They're dumping it into the manure pits. They're dumping them onto fields. And it's really kind of a sad because right now, because of the biology of the cows and whatnot, milk production tends to go up at this time of the year, just the way the cows operate with the coming of spring and whatnot. So the timing could not have been worse for a lot of these farmers. But there are other parts of rural Wisconsin that are heavily dependent upon tourism. And we're not quite into the tourism recreation season yet. So it's a little early for those communities. It's going to hinge on how long this COVID-19 shutdown lasts. If we start to go into the summer, where we still have this stay at home, then the tourist economy is going to be hit. So a lot of rural Wisconsin is going to get a double barrel hit. They're going to get hit on the agriculture side, and then they're going to get hit on the tourism side. But again, it all depends on how long the COVID-19 plays out. And that's why there's been a lot of frustration on the part of trying to estimate the economic impact of this thing, is because it's all going to hinge on how much longer this plays out. And there, it's anybody's guess.
Talking to UW-Madison economist Steve Deller. He's a professor in the Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics, looking at the impact of the coronavirus pandemic on rural parts of the country, rural parts of Wisconsin in particular. If you are living this story right now, call in at 800-642-1234. What are things like if you are in a small town, in a rural community, a farmer yourself, a business operator, an employee who's out of work right now? Please call in 800-642-1234. Steve, is there something about resilience in a smaller community with maybe a little less economic diversity? Does it make it harder to recover from a thing that's hitting everybody right now? Is it going to be harder for rural Wisconsin to bounce back?
It really depends on a lot of factors that are outside the control of these rural communities. For the tourist-dependent rural areas, it depends on tourists coming back in and going. Now, it could be that Wisconsin can benefit, because when we went through the Great Recession, we actually were expecting tourism in Wisconsin to get hit really hard with the Great Recession, but it wasn't. And the reason is because Wisconsin was considered a low-cost alternative for a lot of families in, say, the Chicago area or the Twin Cities area or even the Milwaukee area. Rather than taking the family to Disney World, let's go spend a long weekend up in the Dells or someplace like that. So there was actually a silver lining in that. So it could play out to be a positive thing for Wisconsin tourism, but again, it's simply too early to tell. One of the problems that we've got for the resiliency here is that such a high percentage of rural businesses tend to be small. When I say small, you hear the SBA and, you know, loan eligibility is, you know, businesses are defined as, you know, if you have less than 500 employees, you're small. In a rural community, that's a huge business. Mm-hmm. Most of the businesses in rural Wisconsin have less than 10 employees, less than 5 employees, a lot of self-employed people. Now, the challenge that we face is whether or not these small businesses are going to be able to get access to those SBA loans that are coming out of the CARE Act and other types of programs that are being set up. A lot of these smaller businesses don't have the sophistication or the technical expertise to tap into these programs. In a lot of urban areas, there's kind of resources that you can tap into to help maneuver these things. When you get into rural areas, it's more difficult. The other difficulty is that a lot of these programs you have to apply online for, and like unemployment. And for, depending on where you're at in Wisconsin, one in four households don't have access to broadband, which means that they can't, even if they wanted to apply for, say, unemployment online, they can't. They have to go to the library. Is the library open? There's a lot of these rural areas are really at a comparative disadvantage in dealing with this current situation.
So I'm hearing you saying, Steve, this whole $2 trillion package, if it's going to work in rural Wisconsin for these businesses, as you say, that might not have the resources to seek it out, somebody at the federal level or state or maybe county level is going to have to be a connector here to make sure that those benefits go where they're needed to keep these businesses alive. Am I hearing you right?
Exactly. And that is something the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, WDC, is really trying to step up and do. They're trying to be that connector, that weaver of those networks that are necessary. Now, the question is, you know, it's moving so fast, it's happening so fast, is that are they able to make those connections? So the state is aware of it. WDC is very much aware of that, and they're trying really hard to kind of say that's where they're going to put their resources, is to make those networks and whatnot. The problem is a lot of these rural business owners are very independent. Farmers, for example, tend to be extremely independent, and they have to reach out. They're going to have to reach out. They're going to ask for help. Now, the question is, who do they reach out to? And that's where WDC is trying to facilitate and work with local economic development groups, work with local banking organizations to try to help facilitate that.
We're talking to Steve Deller, professor at UW-Madison's Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics. He's a community development specialist in the Center for Community and Economic Development. He's with us to talk about how rural economies are doing during the COVID-19 outbreak. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 if you are a rural business owner. How have you been impacted by ongoing stay-at-home recommendations? If you're a farmer, how has this outbreak hit your livelihood? If you're in food processing, work at a cheese plant, say, in a rural area, love to hear from you. And just to give us the ground-level look at your community, if you live in a small town, a rural county, what are you seeing so far? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation about how rural economies could face a slow recovery after the COVID-19 outbreak, depending on how things go. Steve Deller is with us, professor at UW-Madison's Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you live in a rural community, a small town, have you seen things change, your economy change over the last couple of months? If you're a small business owner or farmer, how has this impacted you and your livelihood? What would help you at the local, state, national level? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Ray is with us in Milwaukee. Ray, hello.
Hi. I lived on a farm near Dundee, Wisconsin, and I know how difficult it is for rural people to get access to the internet. Here in Milwaukee, I live in Milwaukee now, all the local libraries leave their Wi-Fi on 24/7. So if you have a laptop or a cell phone, you can pull up into the parking lots and get as close to the building as you can, and you can log onto their Wi-Fi. That's how I was able to start my unemployment going, and just stay strong, everybody. Stay strong and help each other, okay?
Ray, you too. Thanks a lot for calling in. Steve, I know libraries, a lot of them around the state, are in talk of a possible phase four federal economic recovery package and talk of including infrastructure funding there. And, you know, this varies by orders of magnitude. Steve, rural broadband, would that be one place where that kind of infrastructure spending might make a difference in rural Wisconsin?
I think at long term, we have to make investments in broadband. It's no longer a luxury. It's become a necessity. The problem with the way a lot of these grants are, the grant programs are being implemented, is that they're grants given to the service provider. The problem is the service providers aren't expanding the range of the service geographically to hit more rural households, more rural businesses. What they're doing is they're using it to upgrade the existing infrastructure that they have. So if you live in a town and you have access to broadband, what they're doing is they're improving the quality of that broadband. They're not investing it out into the rural areas where people that don't have access to it are now getting it. Part of the reason is because that last mile, for example, is extremely expensive. And it's too expensive for the household or for the business to pay for it. It's really kind of unreasonable to expect the service providers to absorb that cost because they're losing money on it. So there needs to be more of a state initiative, more of a federal initiative, but it's got to be targeted towards that last mile. Kind of like the old rural electrification program from 100 years ago, we need that kind of initiative right now. And if there's another stimulus package that comes out, I hope that we think, you know, longer term in terms of broadband.
Thanks for that call, Ray. We'll go to Helene now in Lake Delton. Helene, hello.
Hi there, Rob. Are you still talking about farmers and the dairy business?
We sure are.
I wondered, I get rattled though. I heard you say $17 or more, you know, 17 something a gallon for milk that the farmer gets.
I think that's, Siva, you'd said a
hundredweight.
Hundredweight,
you can get
right.
Three good sized gallons out of a hundredweight, but don't forget there's an awful lot of fingers dipping in. Plus, the farmer has a lot of expense in the first place in order to produce that milk.
Helene, thanks a lot for the call, the clarification. I think at one point you mentioned a retail per gallon price, Steve, and then the 100 weight price was in there too.
That was a good catch. That was my mistake. Yeah, it is 100 weight. But it's still, when you're looking at, I mean, dairy farmers are like looking at, and again, this varies from farmer to farmer to farmer because each farm's cost structure is a little bit different. But you have to be up around $19, $20 a hundredweight before the farm actually is becoming more viable as a business enterprise. They were $17.40. They were moving in the right direction. But now with it down below $13 a hundredweight, it's just, like I say, they're hemorrhaging money.
Thanks a lot for the call. And thanks for the call and the clarification, Helene. We'll go now to Will with us in Eau Claire. Will, hi.
Hi, guys. Thanks for the program. question for your guest about the quantity of money that is in the recently passed stimulus package. In your opinion, is it enough? What's your take on how much more, if any, will be needed for small businesses to come out of this? Thanks.
Thanks, sure. Will. Steve, what do you think?
If the goal is to make small businesses whole so that they feel basically no impact of this shutdown, we're talking multitudes more money is needed. And I don't think that's a fair ask of the federal government. I think what the federal government can do is help minimize the impact of this. We do have a challenge of, how do we pay for the stimulus? The Federal Reserve Bank has kind of stepped up and said that they're going to monetize a lot of this, which means they're going to be printing money. Now, historically, you would think that's a bad idea because that drives inflation, but inflation is really not an issue. So this idea of running a massive deficit to help kind of minimize the impact is not a bad idea. But there is no blank check here. We can't afford a blank check to make this whole. I've heard some estimates that to keep small businesses kind of harmless through this whole process, we're talking 4 or 5 times the amount of money that's being spent. So it's basically to kind of help get over the hurdle. A lot of the programs are really aimed at, particularly the ones that are the loans are forgivable, is that it's essentially a loan for you to pay your workers. Now, a lot of businesses in Wisconsin don't have any paid employees. They're sole proprietor, self-employed people, particularly when you get into rural areas. Historically, they are not eligible for that. But what's different with this CARE Act is that these self-employed people are now eligible for unemployment benefits. They've never been eligible before. So there's kind of it's not going to make you whole, but it's going to take some of the edge off.
Well, thanks a lot for that call. Steve, that's the quantity of money. Let's talk a little bit about quality and how it's used. You were just getting into that some. As this gets hashed out and the money gets allocated state by state, community by community, what do you see as maybe some of the most effective ways, again, not to make everybody whole, but to get people through this thing?
I think that there could be a couple things. For example, they put a moratorium on foreclosures and things like that. Again, it's kind of saying, let's give us a little room to breathe here. Let's get a little room to get through this crisis right now. There are policies that they can put in place that will help with that. It could be delaying the inevitable, but it's kind of taking some of the pressure off. A lot of the grant programs are really aimed at helping you make payroll. So if I have a cheese plant and I have 50 employees and I let 45 of them off, these grants are enabled for me to pay those folks. Now, there's other things like you don't have to pay the Social Security tax. You don't have to pay workers' comp tax off of those things. They're trying to get as much money into the hands of people as possible. Now, if you decide you're going to take one of these loans and you're going to pay off another loan with the bank, then that's not going to be forgiven. You're going to have to pay that back. So there are some fairly stringent strings that are attached. They were pretty targeted in that they wanted this to help workers. And in doing that, it helps the businesses kind of transition through.
Steve, we'll leave it there for now. I'm sure we'll check in with you again on this. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That's Steve Deller, professor in UW-Madison's Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics. He's also a community development specialist in the Center for Community and Economic Development. He joined us today to talk about how rural economies, still in some ways recovering from the Great Recession and trade disputes, could have an uphill battle because of the COVID-19 outbreak. Still time for you to share your perspectives, your thoughts over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll get the latest news in national politics, including the newest federal efforts to deal with the impact of the pandemic. The world faced a major influenza outbreak just over a century ago. We'll look back at Wisconsin history to find out about how the disease affected daily life here in the state. and the Midwest faces economic and ecological challenges in the years to come, the author of the new book Midwest Futures takes us on a tour of some possible roads ahead. That and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time.